Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Does Not Compute. If you haven't already, make sure you check out the other shows on the Spec Network. There are shows to help you level up your design, development, and even business skills. Visit spec.fm to see the full list and get started listening. So, Sean, you mentioned to me that you're trying a new editor. What editor is that?
Just all of them. I'm trying them all.
Just try it out once. Multi-cursor mode, but each cursor is in a different editor.
Each file opens up in a different editor.
Oh, God.
That'd be terrible. Yeah, I've been using VS Code for 3 weeks now, pretty much. I think I opened Atom once to see if there are any updates, and then I stopped myself from using it. I closed it back down. But yeah, I've been using VS Code for a while.
So what made you decide to give VS Code a try? You were using Atom as your full-time before, right?
Yeah, I really don't know. I just have a thing where I need to try them all. And the last few updates on VS Code I thought were really awesome. And I really liked the transparency, I guess, just behind the team that's working on it. You know, obviously, like, Atom is completely open source too, but there was just something about the way that Microsoft is going about developing VS Code that I really liked. And so I just started using it. And one of the things really that won me over was actually the IntelliSense. So under the hood, they use TypeScript typings files for showing documentation inline. So what that means is if you're working with Express, you can have it install the Express typings file, and essentially you get IntelliSense for the Express library. So you can, you know, you can use express.whatever, and then it'll show you all the methods that are available. But not only that, is as soon as you scope into a method, it shows you the actual documentation, like the arguments it takes, the types of each argument, etc. So I thought that was a really, really useful feature.
Is that for JS stuff only, or does it have IntelliSense for other languages as well?
There's IntelliSense for other languages. You just have to install packages for them. I know there's a good Ruby package. I don't know if IntelliSense comes with it. But another thing that I use a lot actually is the built-in debugger. And with Ruby, for example, you can install the GemRuby debug IDE. So before I was using Bybug, and then I would just Bybug through the terminal. And now I can actually set breakpoints in the code. And then I have there's a whole pane for debugging. So you can see all the call stack, you can see all the local variables, et cetera. It's actually really useful. And so obviously that works with JavaScript. It works with whatever. There's a bunch of language plugins it'll work for.
That's really cool. Yeah. I mean, I used in my original programming job, I did some C# and I used Visual Studio a little bit. And the autocomplete was always just ridiculously impressive. IntelliSense is super well done, maybe better than any other editor I've ever used. So that definitely seems like it would be a pretty great selling feature. I mean, it's to the point where sometimes in normal Visual Studio, at least, where you can just type, you know, 5 characters and autocomplete the rest of an entire line.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I don't think it's that good yet, but it's definitely coming along. And the fact that it shows documentation in line in terms of like what arguments this function takes and the types of arguments, I think is pretty great. And there's also other things too, like there's a peak functionality, so that way I can right click on a method or right click on something that gets imported and I can click on peak into file, and that way it opens a little split in line in my editor and I can actually make changes to the file that I just peeked into and save it. So that way you can actually move around pretty quickly and make changes pretty quickly without having to have lots of context, which is pretty nice too.
That sounds very cool. I'm still on Sublime.
Sublime's okay. It's pretty good. There's some pretty cool. I actually have this Sublime dev channel downloaded, and I check that out every once in a while. And there's some cool updates coming to it. They're working on it for sure.
Yeah, it's actually been getting fairly regular updates lately, which is pretty cool. I think 3 is getting close to a final release. And it actually kind of has some similar things to what you're saying with the peaking. You can hover over method names now and it'll show you where in the code that is and give you a bit more context on it, which is nice. I haven't used that a ton at this point, but mostly just because I'm not familiar with it yet. I'm not used to doing that action, so I don't think about it. But it is pretty cool, and I'm glad to see that it's not going full on TextMate. Like, it is actually still getting updates at least once in a while.
Yeah, and I think the update frequency has been increasing as well, especially since they hired Wes Boss. So it's pretty cool to see that. You know, I still love Sublime. I use it sometimes if I feel like my computer, especially my MacBook, if my MacBook feels like it's getting bogged down or something, I'll use Sublime. But that's another thing that I liked about VS Code was that it's noticeably more performant than Atom, which maybe it's like a nitpicky thing, but again, the last thing you want to think about as you're working is, oh, this is taking a long time, because that'll totally derail whatever you're thinking about. At least it will for me.
Do you have any sense of like why it's faster, since they're both using the same underlying engine? They're both written in JavaScript, yeah?
Yeah, they're both essentially Electron or Node apps. So there's actually a good article that one of the VS Code devs wrote. Somebody asked them, and he wrote a pretty detailed response. I'll have to find it, put it in the show notes. I don't remember off the top of my head. But essentially, they have, previous to VS Code, they had an editor called Monaco, I think. If that's wrong, I'll put a correction in the show notes. But I think it was called Monaco, and they use it in a couple other products as well. And so basically, they had already pre-existing text editing engine they wrapped into a Node app. So they already had some experience around optimizing, at least, you know, WebKit or web views for being performant like that. So I think that's how they're able to do it, is that they've already had a lot of research in that area previously to creating VS Code.
Well, yeah, I guess at some point I'll have to give it a shot. You always got to try the new editors. That's the one thing I still let myself be fiddly about, I feel like.
Yeah, the thing to know about VS Code is that, like Sublime and Atom, they almost have like a one-to-one keyboard shortcut mapping. VS Code does not. It has different keyboard shortcuts, which will drive you nuts for the first few days. But once you get them down, it's fine. That was the biggest barrier for me, honestly, was the keyboard shortcuts. And there's a plugin you can use that auto maps the keyboard shortcuts to match Sublime's, I believe. But again, you know, if the app updates, it could break that or something. And the other thing about VS Code is it's just as extensible as Atom is. So if you want to go and make your own keyboard shortcuts, that's totally fine too. Actually, you know what, Paul? Now that I think about it, the most useful thing for me so far, and it's a really small thing, it's pretty, you know, negligible, I think, maybe. Maybe not, because it's really useful for me. But I've been doing lots of Node development for the past year or so. And so I end up always using different NPM tasks. And typically, I end up having to open up Terminal to run a few tasks and go back to my editor. And VS Code actually has support for NPM tasks built in, like a task runner built in. So you can actually set up a task file, and then from the UI, you can just run all of your NPM tasks. So for example, today I was working on a blog post, and I started up VS Code. I didn't even have to open iTerm. I just started up VS Code. I opened up the terminal inside of VS Code. I turned on the dev stuff. And then as soon as I wanted to deploy, I just did run task deploy, enter, and then my website was updated.
Yeah, man. You can do that in Sublime too, though.
And I'm sure Atom can do it. I mean, that's the thing. Like, the other editors can do it as well. I just never...
Sublime's got build tasks.
For whatever reason, I just never use those features.
Yeah, I think a lot of that is probably because of how VS Code is marketed and what people already know about Visual Studio, that it is more of an IDE. So they're expecting more of those IDE-like features. Whereas in Sublime, you think of it more as a text editor, even though it does have a lot of that stuff kind of buried under the hood. Like, Sublime definitely has build scripts, and they're pretty great. I've used them in the past, but I think most people haven't, just because of that perception, which is kind of weird, but I mean, it also makes sense at the same time.
Yeah, I think it's a difference in how they're surfaced, because VS Code surfaces them really well. It's like a first class kind of feature, whereas Sublime, I feel like, I mean, it's not like a second class feature, because it works and it works well. It's just not necessarily marketed, like you said.
Right. And I mean, a lot of Sublime is actually like that. There's so much, Sublime does so much stuff. And really the only way to find that out is to either read through like the forums or the deep corners of the documentation, or just look through every single menu in the menu bar, which I have done, just because I've used it for so long at this point. But it's interesting that people are like, oh, VS Code has this. It's like, well, Sublime does too, but nobody cares.
Poor Sublime. Yeah, it gets kicked around a lot.
Poor Sublime. But yeah, anybody who wants to mess with that, you can hit Command B to do your whatever your primary build is, which you probably won't know if you haven't used this. Or you can hit Command Shift B, which gives you a list of all the available build commands that you might want to run. And then you can just kind of edit those and add new ones from the tools menu, which is great. So, Sean, you launched another new side project thing today. It seems like you're on a roll lately. You're just putting together all sorts of stuff. This is a topic search for Does Not Compute, actually, which is kind of cool. A little bit of a meta thing.
It's pretty meta. It actually was, I can't remember what episode it was, but I was building a Tide search thing a while back. And Yeah, it turns out most of the APIs are terrible.
Long time ago, yeah.
I pivoted. Actually, if you look at a GitHub repo, I link to the GitHub repo. It's open source on the blog post. But yeah, if you look in the source, you can actually see a commit that says pivot. And yeah, so now it is a topic search for does not compute. And we've always kind of talked about side projects being important, allowing you to kind of explore and without any pressure, without any deadlines and clients and such. And I recently had to build a React app that used Redux for the first time. And so I just kind of wanted to dive into Vuex because I hadn't used Vuex 2.0. So that's basically why I worked on this. It was a means to an end to learn the new version of Vuex.
What's the verdict?
It's good. It's just fine. It reminded me a lot more of Redux than version one did, but that's not a bad thing. I think Redux is great. I think that Vuex 2 is great, and I hope people use both. Specifically with Vuex, the use of modules, I think you mentioned that in the last episode, was pretty okay. So basically, let's just talk about, you know, the topic search. So in the topic search, there are a search filters module, and there is also an episodes module. And so all of the data regarding the search form and the filters and stuff like that is scoped to that module, and all of the data regarding the episode is scoped to the episodes module. And so the episodes module is not just an array full of episodes. It's an object that has stuff in it like fetching true or false, fetched true or false, errors, you know, null or an array or an object or something, right? So essentially that's like your namespace kind of container for that section of the application. And anything that happens regarding the episodes happens within that module, which I think is super great because then you can section off, you know, different pieces of data. You don't have to go ahead and build one giant object for your entire application state and have it in one spot. You can section it up, which makes it a lot easier to kind of keep your mind wrapped around it.
Right. I mean, it's in some ways kind of like the model of your application. It's just a nice, you can break out each type of thing, which is basically a model, into its own module, and then just compose your app's data structure out of those modules, which I think is that seems like the most sensible way to approach that to me.
Yeah. And it turns out it works great. If you're coming from Redux, it's basically the same thing as using combine reducers. So Redux has a method called combine reducers, and you pass it essentially the same exact thing as what the modules are. It's just an object of state. And I mean, well, the reducers, you actually get the reducers that come in there, but it's the same idea. So that way you're basically namespacing your chunks of data, and it just works really well. So, I mean, in the beginning, like Redux and Vuex, they are kind of hard to wrap my head around because there's a bunch of different steps. There's, with Vuex, there's mutations, there's actions, you know, there's modules. What do you put in what? And, you know, how do you approach like asynchronous requests in there? And yeah, it's just a lot to bite off, but you kind of have to struggle through it. And once you struggle through it, it'll click. And then I feel a lot more empowered now. I feel like I can build much more complicated applications because I have kind of like a blueprint to go ahead and do that. Whereas previously I had some ideas on how to structure applications that are, you know, more complicated than simple CRUD or like lists or something like that. But when you're sticking to the conventions of Vuex or Redux, I feel like it kind of empowers you to make things that are more complicated, but it's actually easier to reason about.
Yeah. And I mean, we kind of talked on this last week, I think, at least a bit, but a lot of this stuff exists not for beginners and not for people who are making something really simple. It exists for people who do want to do more complex stuff, which is why it is more complex. And that's important to keep in mind, especially if you're just getting started, that this might not be something you want to jump into right away. You might want to put something really just that you can understand and that is simple and that just works for you first. And then kind of as you start to grasp, oh, here were my pain points when I did this other thing, let me try it this way. And I think that's a much more natural progression to kind of get into a lot of these more complex tools. They are super great and they're super useful, but they are more complex still at the end of the day. And you have to keep that in mind when you're learning.
Exactly. And when you say they're more complex, it's also worth noting that they're more complicated at first, and then you get used to it, and then it's not so bad. You know what I mean? It's kind of like you level up, you kind of go up a few steps, and then you're good, and then there's another plateau that you have to climb, essentially. But yeah, you get used to it eventually.
Well, in some ways, it's more like if you do something, let's say you just do it in plain jQuery, you build an app just in jQuery, and that's fine. You can get something working. But then what I've noticed, at least for me, tends to happen is that the complexity never stops growing. It continues to go up. And the longer you work on the app, more features you add to the app, generally speaking, just the more complex and harder to work with that code base is going to get over time. But with something like Vuex or Redux, or even just Vue and React, to take it back a step from there, what my experience has been is that there is a lot more initial complexity. But once you've actually built out your app, once you understand the concepts, you kind of hit a plateau of complexity where adding new features, changing things actually doesn't increase the overall complexity of your app as nearly as much, at least, as just doing something with plain JavaScript or something like jQuery.
Well, it's kind of like a friend of the show, Kelly Sutton, says, like, you told me this originally, but every Sinatra app eventually becomes a Rails app, or wants to become a Rails app, which, I mean, that's dead on, you know?
Yeah.
It helps with maintainability. I mean, with Redux, knowing that, or Vuex, knowing that all of your stuff, like, you know where the changes are happening. Your changes are only happening in one spot. You know where all the actions are. They're all happening, you know, in one spot. It just makes it a lot easier to reason about, especially if you're working with multiple teams. Another couple of things I thought were pretty cool were that some of the conventions are just like one-to-one translation between Vuex and Redux, whereas, like, if you look at the docs for Vuex, he makes a mutation type file, which essentially just translates strings to constants like we talked about doing in Redux. You get, you know, build time errors versus runtime errors. So I thought that was pretty cool. And for me, it made it really easy just to kind of hop over and be productive with Vuex.
I guess to bring it back to a music analogy, because we always do that.
I can't help it.
Complex tools are sort of like compressors, audio compressors, where they raise the bass level, which in audio would be volume, but in this case is complexity, but they also put a cap on how loud or complex something can get.
This is true.
Yeah.
But another thing I wanted to mention, and I thought this was so cool, and I talked about it in the blog post that I mentioned, is the idea of time travel debugging. It's for me, it's groundbreaking, and I don't know, it's so cool. Anyway, if you're not familiar with how Redux or Vuex works, essentially you have a copy of your state, and whenever the state needs to change, you actually make a copy of the state, change it, and return the new copy. So essentially you get a stack of papers, and those papers, each individual paper represents the current state of the application. And so because you have a history there, you have a copy of each of the state at each change, these dev tools, what they're doing is they're creating an interface where you can actually click forward and backward through time as data changes, which is just unbelievable. So for example, if Paul and I are working on an application and I'm like maybe six screens deep, you know, I'm clicking around, submitting forms, and then I find this random bug. Typically what I have to do is, you know, I have to go to him and say, hey, I found a bug. This is kind of how I did it.
Yeah, here's these six steps to reproduce.
Exactly. But with these tools, they give you an import and export function. So you can literally export the state, the history of the state. And I can say, hey, Paul, here's exactly what happened. And he can literally click through next and previous, see how the state's changing, and reproduce the bug just like that, which I think is unbelievable.
That is really cool. How does the import and export deal with stuff like local or like auth, for example?
That's a good question. I think, so for example, if you're logging into an API and that API returns a JWT token, that's what'll happen. So as far as I understand, and I could be wrong, but as far as I understand, is, you know, as long as you're clicking around the state, so if you click onto a view, if you go back and click forward and it goes onto a view that fires off an AJAX request, I don't think it'll fire off the AJAX request because it already has the data that the server gave it.
Interesting. So it actually is the full local state. That's pretty cool. I guess since it all exists in that store, that does make sense. That would just be the entire state of the application. Huh.
Yeah. So for example, you know, if you're doing lots of data intensive stuff or lots of AJAX intensive stuff, it's a lot quicker because you can jump back four screens and it's not going to have to refetch all that information.
Right. And I imagine that would also make it easier, not just for dev tools, but if you wanted to implement something like undo redo in your app, this would make that much simpler.
Exactly. Yeah. It's pretty wild. I mean, I'm sure with React, there's already a module to do that, or a middleware to do that, or something like that. And I'm sure someone will make it for Vuex. But yeah, I mean, it makes really complicated stuff that much easier to work with.
That is pretty awesome. Very cool.
Yeah. So I feel like I've yammered on for a while about what I'm doing. What have you been working on? I know you've been pretty busy lately too.
Yeah, I mean, lately a lot of the stuff I've been doing has been getting more deep into like metaprogramming kind of things. So I actually just put together a new tool for Imagix. It's called Gearbox. I can't remember if I've talked about it on the show or not before. But basically what it does is it lets us Imagix employees build out demos and then embed them, and they're all live. So for example, if you go to the Imagix docs site, which is just docs.imagix.com, you can see some of these in our API examples. We'll get a couple links in show notes, of course. But basically you can have, it'll show like an image, and then you'll get some tools that are actually defined by us down below. And so for example, it might show blur, and you can drag a little slider to blur the image, just to kind of give a nice way for people to get a demo of what these parameters actually do in practice and what the values look like. And part of that was building out an editor that is based off our internal API schema that allows us to create those examples. So when you say that you want to add, I don't know, a rect, you want to be able to specify an X, Y width and height to crop an image. It actually shows a custom component based on that, because that's what's in the spec. So it loads in our JSON schema spec, which actually contains information about every single parameter and what type of values it expects, and then generates a UI based off of that information. So I've kind of been getting into a lot more of that kind of stuff. I'm using JSON schema is incredible. I'm using it for like everything now, and it's the best. Have you messed with this at all, Sean?
I have not, but it sounds pretty wild. So you're literally building UIs based off of a schema that you create, a bit list of rules you create, and the UI builds itself.
Yeah, exactly. And JSON schema is really, it looks pretty ugly at first, and it's the documentation is not great. Actually, the best docs for it are this third party guide with a big octopus on it. Yeah, I just sent this to you. It's really weird, but they actually do a great job of explaining it and giving real world examples. But it allows you to do all sorts of stuff. You can, so in another side project that I'm working on, it's sort of like your journaling app, I guess, except there can be custom entries. Mm-hmm. It's not just text, not just markdown. You can have like a specific type of event. So let's say for whatever this type of event is, we would create an event type model, and then the event type model itself has a schema that defines the type of schemas that they can have. And this is getting pretty in the weeds and convoluted, but essentially what this allows me to do using JSON schema is I have an initial schema that allows admins to create additional schemas that specify what users can enter. Hmm. And so the initial schema is used to generate a UI for the admin, and then the admin saves that, which is validated against the initial schema, which generates a second schema that generates a UI for users to enter data and validate against. It's very strange to reason about, but it makes things so much easier. There's not another way to do that kind of stuff that I'm aware of. So it's very deep in the weeds, meta programming stuff, but it's been a blast.
Well, it sounds to me like that's the most efficient way to do it. So you say that users can add a bunch of different types of entries, and instead of hard coding a component form for each entry type, you're just building a schema file, and then you have a few components that you have like a generic, you know, like text input or whatever that just generates itself or builds itself. The UI builds itself based off of your schema. That sounds so efficient. It's crazy.
Yeah. And that's exactly the same concept as what I did with Gearbox, where it looks at the schema and then generates a UI based off of that, both for creating the sub schemas as well as for displaying those to users, like saying, here's the five options you have access to. So let's say you can adjust the text, you can adjust the size of the text, and you can adjust the color and font. So that's four things. Each one of those is going to have a different type of input. For selecting the font, you want a select that already shows all of the possible values, and so that gets pulled in from the schema. For selecting the size of the text, you want to be able to just drag a little slider. For selecting the color, you want, you know, a nice color input. And so it automatically looks at the schema and says, what is this thing? What is text color? Oh, it's supposed to be a color input. Cool, I'll just display that. And so you just make generic components, like you were saying, for each type of thing, and then they automatically get selected and ordered based on the schema that is created.
No, that sounds incredible. I mean, that sounds like a full usage of what components are supposed to be used for. You know, instead of having a one-off component that is pretty tied to, you know, specific things, you have components that just take data and they render that data. So you can just basically give it whatever you want and you get what you want.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in a lot of ways, it's kind of the server-side equivalent of the stuff you've been working on lately.
Yeah, that's true. Which is funny because when you're talking about this stuff, so in the blog post I keep talking about, I mentioned in the beginning how we've been talking about specialization and how front end has always been the most interesting thing to me, and how API work has been more of a means to an end because I need data to build a UI. And yeah, so it sounds like you're just kind of pushing farther into this really cool area in the back end, and I'm doing that, but on the other side, on the front end.
Yeah. It's almost like we would work really well together or something.
It's almost like that, Paul.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of Does Not Compute. If you enjoy the show, please remember to rate or review us in iTunes. We really appreciate it, and it only takes a minute. There's a link in the show notes.